Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Dave James. In a moment, I'll talk to someone who heads an agency that monitors facilities around Ohio for abuse and neglect of the disabled. Courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, Tracy Townsend will talk about Governor Mike DeWine's positive, then negative test for COVID-19. Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose will talk about the upcoming election, and Tracy talks to Central Ohio members of Congress about the pandemic. And I'll wrap up the hour talking with Terry Green, founder and executive director of Think, Make, Live Youth. It's a local nonprofit that helps empower youth. First up on Columbus Perspective, I'm talking with Shearston Schoberg, who is the executive director of an organization called Disability Rights Ohio. How are you?
I'm doing great today. Thank you.
Thanks for talking to us. Tell us what Disability Rights Ohio is.
So Disability Rights Ohio is a not-for-profit, and our mission is to advocate for the legal, civil, and human rights of people with disabilities. And we're fortunate to actually receive federal funding to do this work under grants called Protection and Advocacy System grants. We're designated as the Protection and Advocacy System for the entire state of Ohio.
Okay, and how long has it been around?
So the not-for-profit has been around since 2012, but our predecessor organization has been around since the 80s, and the protection and advocacy system was actually started in the beginning of the 1980s, actually as a result of investigative journalism that exposed some pretty horrific conditions in an institution for people with disabilities in New York, which led to congressional findings and led to the funding of this federal advocacy program.
And I was looking on the agency's website about you. You've been there for several years, and you became the executive director just at exactly the time that this pandemic broke open.
That's right. I started here in 2009 as the legal director and took on some additional roles over my 11 years leading up to becoming executive director, which didn't occur until March 1st. And within 2 weeks, we were sending our staff to work from home and adjusting to figure out how to do our monitoring and investigation work without actually going in person into facilities like we normally would.
And that is fascinating because you do monitor what's going on and how the disabled are treated, and you are still doing that even with everything that's going on.
That's right. That function of monitoring to be able to find out what concerns people with disabilities have, particularly those that might be more isolated in an institutional setting, as well as to investigate allegations of abuse and neglect, that is the reason the protection advocacy system and funding was set up. And we knew we needed to keep that core function going, even when we did not think it was safe for us to go in person. We didn't want to, you know, risk bringing the virus, for example, into a congregate care facility where individuals are themselves medically vulnerable to more significant complications or even death, as we've seen. As well as putting our own staff at risk. We just didn't know what to expect and how to protect either party. But we knew we needed to keep that going, and so we kind of set our team loose to figuring out how can we do this with other means, you know, using phone or video or other sort of virtual methods.
Give us an example of the type of facilities that you're looking at and what you're looking for.
So we actually can go into and do indeed routinely monitor a wide range of facilities, nursing facilities, you know, nursing homes, nursing facilities for sure, psychiatric hospitals, institutions for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, other sort of licensed mental health treatment facilities for youth or adults. And a wide range. We can even monitor in jails and prisons, although doing that remotely has proven to be much more of a challenge than the other types of settings. And for the remote monitoring, we actually did a wide range, including all of those, besides jails and prisons, all of those types that I just mentioned. So nursing homes, psychiatric hospitals, other licensed mental health treatment centers, and institutions for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And we actually were able to monitor 86 of those between mid-April and mid-June.
Wow. Talking with Shearston Schoberg, she is the executive director of Disability Rights Ohio. When you say monitor, then what does that entail?
What that entails is going in and talking to the staff to find out sort of what's happening, particularly in this pandemic environment. We really wanted to find out if there were new challenges that they were experiencing, things that we might be able to help advocate to make sure that the rights of the individuals they're serving are protected. One of the things, of course, that we identified was concerns around access to personal protective equipment or in nursing homes in particular. They just didn't have the space they needed to adequately quarantine, and that's part of why many of them were much more severely impacted by the number of cases and deaths. We also want to talk to the individuals with disabilities that are receiving services at whatever place it is, whether it's a nursing home or a psychiatric hospital. And we were able to work with each of the different places we went to set up a way to do that privately. As part of our monitoring and investigation authority allows us to speak privately with any individual with a disability, regardless of where they're at, regardless of whether they have a guardian, even if they're a minor. And we wanted to make sure that that privacy and that ability to speak to us confidentially was still protected, even in this virtual environment. And we were really pleased that every place was willing to work creatively with us to, you know, set people up in a private room, give them a phone or an iPad or some other device that they could speak to us either by phone or even over video. And we were able to use a variety of different platforms, either something the facility preferred to use or we have a Zoom account. So, you know, we were just flexible and would work out how to do that. And what we're trying to do is find out what are the concerns of the individuals that are receiving services, make sure they understand their rights, that they know they can contact us if they have concerns. And then again, from the staff to get a sense of what's happening and what challenges they're seeing sort of on a system-wide level so that we can provide advocacy for the individual's rights.
It's really been quite a fascinating story and lesson for all of us to find out exactly what can be done when we're pushed to a limit.
That's right. I mean, we really, you know, it took us about a month to really get this going because we did have to adjust the way we did things. But I'm just so proud of how many places and people we were able to reach. And what we've learned is even when we hope to sometime in the next few months be able to start going in on, you know, in person again, even when we start doing that, we want to continue these other methods. And between now and then, we'll continue these virtual methods so that we can keep reaching people where they're at and possibly reach more people, because we were able to do more with this virtual method than we had had planned to do on site if we had kept with our original planning for the year.
Under normal circumstances, do you do sometimes, I don't know what the word would be for it, but surprise inspections, things like that?
Absolutely. So normally if we're doing a monitoring, which is not based on any particular sort of complaint or concern, normally those are announced and we set those up in advance. But if we get a complaint about abuse or neglect, we frequently do unannounced visits in order to investigate those allegations. And we're continuing to investigate allegations of abuse or neglect even without going on site. So we can call without setting up anything in advance and ask to speak to individuals that we need to, whether it's the person that may be the victim of abuse, whether it's interviewing staff about what happened. We also have, with this same federal grant program, we have access authority, which includes that ability to go on site and do unannounced visits or talk to people privately, but it also gives us the ability to get records in certain circumstances. And so, you know, while we're investigating abuse and neglect, we can sometimes get video, we can get pictures, we can get reports of the investigation that happened about the abuse and neglect internally. And that can help us to then advocate for the rights of the person that might have been abused or neglected, or to look for sort of changes that can happen on the system-wide level so that abuse and neglect is prevented going forward.
Talking with Sheersten Schoberg, Executive Director of Disability Rights Ohio, are the unannounced visits based on situations where you are aware something may be going on, or are they sometimes kind of random?
So generally we use unannounced visits when we have a particular concern that we feel like we need to go out there without any sort of opportunity to potentially, you know, cover up evidence, or we want to respect the privacy of the person who may be the victim of the abuse, so we don't want to preview in advance that we're coming out to investigate a particular incident, so we'll show up and ask the questions we need to, speak to the people we need to, and things like that. But we generally prefer to only use that when necessary and where we can to work with places to set up a visit. We tend to, for monitoring, where we're trying to get a sense of the whole system, the whole facility, and talk to as many people, residents, and staff as possible, generally more effective if we set that up with the facility in advance so that we have the right people there and we get better information as a result.
If you're investigating cases of abuse or perhaps violation of civil rights, can you give us a couple of examples of what might be happening that you're looking at?
So certainly physical abuse, if individuals are being, hit or they are being physically restrained in a way that is painful or against sort of appropriate treatment methods. That's a common thing. Individuals that might be secluded or isolated inappropriately, like in a seclusion room, is another common thing. Allegations of sexual assault, unfortunately, is an area that we look into. And then, other areas of sort of like significant medical neglect or in jails and prisons, we frequently are looking at lack of access to medical care or mental health treatment and services. That's a big issue in jails and prisons that we've been working on for years, as well as sort of a lack of or inappropriate response to suicide ideation and suicide prevention.
For some of these folks who may have a diminished sense of awareness, maybe they are still able to detect that something is different under the pandemic with social distancing or, whatever else might be changing. That must be, another difficult addition to what they're already going through.
Absolutely. It just as the pandemic has caused, stress and problems for all of us, people with disabilities have experienced that. And oftentimes it's been exacerbated. Many people with disabilities can't practice some of the things that the rest of us are told to do, that sort of physical or social distancing. When you might rely upon someone to help you with physical care needs, you aren't able to keep that level of distance. When you're in a congregate care facility, you might not be able to have the same control over who you come into contact with. Or in this instance, out of necessity, the state has limited visitation, for example. So individuals are becoming more and more isolated, which is, of course, going to increase anxiety, increase, difficulties in communication. For example, one of the nursing facilities that we monitored had a significant number of individuals that were both deaf and blind. Well, the form of communication they use is very touch-based and tactile and in-person, right? It's very difficult to meet with any virtual method, and that was a serious concern both for our ability to do the kind of monitoring we wanted to do and for them to be able to have contact with family members and friends. So, all of the sort of barriers that people with disabilities experience on a, daily basis, unfortunately, in our society, whether it's lack of access to services or abuse and neglect, all of those in isolation and institutions, all of those things have been sort of exacerbated by this pandemic.
And for caregivers, their stress level also obviously ratcheting up. Are you hearing, anecdotally or otherwise stories of just the workplace itself becoming more difficult in these facilities?
Absolutely. Family members of people with disabilities are also, having their both anxiety, their increased sort of need to provide services themselves, whether it's maybe a choice that they've made, hard choice, right, to potentially limit the number of people that the family or the individual comes in contact with, so they might decide to provide more supports themselves, which is challenging when they also have to worry about work or other childcare or things like that. Or we've also heard from family members that have actually limited their own contact with the person who doesn't live with them, and they've limited their own contact because they're worried about bringing the virus to someone that is medically more vulnerable. And so that, that's a strain on that important supportive relationship. With the schools struggling with how to provide learning and a lot of questions about what's going to happen in the fall, as well as the shutdowns that happened in the virtual learning that happened in this spring, we've had a lot of parents that are very concerned about whether their students with disabilities are going to get the kind of education that they need, and are they already starting to get behind and lose essential skills because they're not getting the supports and services that they need.
Talking with Kirsten Schoberg, she is the Executive Director of Disability Rights Ohio. The guidelines that you're under right now doing this monitoring virtually, is that under some sort of health order from the governor, or is that your policy, or and when does all that start to go back to normal?
So we made an internal decision to not do on-site visits for at least the time being. We have not been told by the state that we can't do them. In fact, we're having very productive conversations right now with the Ohio Department of Health about how we can get access to personal protective equipment so that we can start going back into facilities when it's really necessary to go in person. And we want to have that ability. And so we're on basically the list to be able to access that equipment. We're talking about having our staff fitted for, you know, the most significant level, that N95 level, for certain circumstances. And they've been very supportive and understanding of our role as an independent advocate that has this access authority and this important function.
Cases of abuse and neglect of individuals with disabilities, how does that compare to maybe 10, 20 years ago? And is it more of an individual thing, or is it a systemic problem?
So it's certainly going to have elements of both, but I think that there are many systemic factors that tend to contribute to an increased risk of experiencing abuse or neglect or being a victim of crime for a person with disability. And some of those increased factors are, you know, depending potentially physically on someone else to provide care, which puts you in a position where you may be less likely to complain. And, you know, if something is happening that you're not comfortable with, you might not want to say anything. You might even give the person the benefit of the doubt because you like them generally, even if potentially what they're doing is wrong. You might have less access to someone to complain that you feel safe complaining to. That's part of why our independent access is so important, because we are someone that they can speak to confidentially, and we're not going to report it to a service provider without their permission. Whereas, you know, if they don't have family, for example, that they have a lot of contact with and they're in a facility, they may not feel safe complaining to anyone at the facility because they're worried about retaliation. So those kind of systemic factors, you know, lack of access to other support networks aside from the person that's providing care, dependence on care, sometimes barriers in the ability to communicate in the usual ways that the rest of us communicate can lead to someone both being more likely to be taken advantage of and abused and less likely to be able to effectively report it. So, well, of course, there's going to be individual circumstances with people that are, you know, quote, bad actors. There's a lot of systemic factors that allow that type of abuse and neglect to occur and lead to what, you know, we have sometimes find as almost like a culture of abuse, where a lack of dignity, a lack of respect by the service providers vis-a-vis the individuals they're serving, as well as the barriers that those individuals are experiencing in being independent and communicating, can be a really bad recipe for systemic abuse and neglect.
In these facilities, when there is finally a complaint or some sort of, you know, when word finally gets to you that something needs to be checked there, does it originate from maybe another worker there? Or, I mean, some of these folks obviously wouldn't be able to report something on their own. Some would, but where does it start?
Well, it's a wide variety that we get reports or complaints. There are incident reports that have to be filled out, and the vast majority of facilities complete those when they need to. And even if, you know, the whether they find that there was abuse or neglect, at least the allegation is there. And we get copies of many of those incident reports in the mental health system as well as the developmental disability system, for example. So we can review those for sort of, you know, the kind of more significant concerns like sexual abuse or physical injury from a physical restraint and things like that, or a concern where we're seeing a trend at a facility. We can then open an investigation to find out what's happening and see if we can advocate. So that's one way we get information. people can call us, or information is required to be posted in certain types of places, like state psychiatric hospitals, for example, and they can call us, and they aren't allowed to be restricted from calling us, even if they have phone restrictions for other phone calls. And they call and make complaints, family members call and make complaints, and then we do sometimes get complaints from the service provider themselves, sometimes anonymously, sometimes, you know, they're willing to put their name on it, but we have that ability to keep it confidential and anonymous, which makes it more possible for us to get that information.
Talking with Kirsten Schoberg, she is the Executive Director of Disability Rights Ohio. Just a moment or two to go. Anything else you'd like to add?
I really appreciate that you are taking an interest in our work, and so great to be able to continue our work during the pandemic. And we really hope that people will call us if they're concerned about abuse and neglect, or if they have any other issue that they feel like they could use some advocacy or maybe some information on their rights, particularly if they're struggling with these exacerbated or new barriers with the coronavirus.
It's such important work because, you know, you shudder to think what would be happening if there was no oversight.
It is very challenging. And, you know, even as much as I think we do a fantastic job, unfortunately, we can't be everywhere either. And so it's, there's a need for the other organizations that provide oversight, whether it's licensing agencies. There's a very robust abuse and neglect investigation process within the DD system, not quite as robust within the mental health system. So that's an area we'd like to see improve. There's a long-term care ombudsman that's very effective in nursing facilities. So we're not alone in this, but the difference is that those are sort of state entities with very sort of specific kind of prescribed processes they have to go through. We're an advocate. We don't have the authority to take someone's license, but we also have the flexibility to advocate based on what the individual wants to see. And we can do things like release public reports, for example, about an investigation in order to raise awareness within the public and to kind of put pressure on both the facility and maybe the licensing agencies to take more aggressive action to fix problems.
It's very interesting and important work. It's fascinating. Kirsten Schoberg, again, joining us. She's the Executive Director of Disability Rights Ohio. Can folks find out more on a website?
Absolutely. If you want to check out our website, it's disabilityrightsohio.org. And we also have an intake line available across the state of Ohio. And that's 1-800-282-9181.
Kirsten, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Todd Markowitz, Vice President and General Manager of Radio Ohio, which owns 97.1 The Fan. We're an equal opportunity employer dedicated to providing broad outreach efforts regarding job vacancies within our company. We seek the help of local organizations in referring qualified applicants. Organizations that wish to receive our vacancy information should send their request to the attention of Human Resources, Radio Ohio, 770 Twin Rivers Drive, Columbus, 43215. If you'd like to view our current job openings, please visit our website at 971thefan.com, and thanks for listening.
You are not your diagnosis.
A medical chart is not your identity.
And vision loss does not define you.
Your drive shows who you are.
And you are not alone.
Because we are driven too.
To be a beacon of strength.
A champion of courage.
An advocate for hope.
You are not alone.
Because we are stronger together.
We drive the research for the cures we are finding.
We're fighting macular degeneration,
retinitis pigmentosa,
Usher syndrome,
and the entire spectrum of blinding retinal diseases.
We fund.
We fight.
We win.
We are the foundation fighting blindness.
Together, we are fighting blindness.
Join the fight at fightingblindness.org.
We are advocates.
We are defenders.
We are champions.
And friends.
We are the Association of Zoos and Aquariums.
230 accredited members employing thousands.
All dedicated to the care and conservation of Earth's precious wildlife.
Sea turtles.
African penguins.
California condors.
Cheetahs.
And countless endangered species that are close to extinction.
See for yourself at aza.org/join us.
Or at an AZA accredited zoo and aquarium today.
Meet Ed, movie buff, animal lover, safe driver.
5 years of driving an ambulance teaches you a thing or two. If people knew what I know, lives could be saved. When I see a car trying to rush past a turning bus, I get concerned. You see, when big vehicles turn right, they have to swing wide to make the turn. And that's a lesson you don't want to learn the hard way. When trucks and buses turn, let's you and I wait.
It's our roads.
It's our safety.
Visit www.sharetheroadsafely.gov.
This is Columbus Perspective on the Fan, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV. Here's Tracy Townsend from her Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. Here's Tracy.
We do thank you for joining us this Sunday morning. I'm Tracy Townsend. We're going to start with that back and forth surrounding Governor Mike DeWine's COVID-19 tests.
When I got to the airport, found out shortly thereafter that I had tested positive. So that was a big surprise.
Well, what was even more surprising? The result of the governor's second COVID-19 test. Governor DeWine took a test so that he could see the president. That rapid test from the White House showed that DeWine had the virus. The governor took another test through Columbus Public Health and then went on to his Cedarville home to quarantine. The results from the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center showed the governor does not have the virus. Before the second test results came back, the governor addressed the state.
The idea was I was going to get tested, which I did. Everyone who sees the president is tested. So I was tested. I went from there to the airport. And when I got to the airport, found out shortly thereafter that I had tested positive. So that was a big surprise. Obviously could not see the president, could not greet the president. It had been my intention to be there to greet him when he flew into Cleveland. Called Fran and headed back and stopped in Columbus. And Fran and I, some of the people who worked very, very closely with me, were tested. It was not a rapid test, so we do not have the test back yet. But, you know, I feel fine, have a headache, I get a lot of headaches throughout my life. So a headache is not anything that unusual. So besides that, I feel well. So a big surprise to me and certainly a big surprise to our family. When I found out, I called Fran, then I called each of our 7 children, because I figured the news would be out pretty quickly. So I wanted them to hear that directly from me. And I was able to reach all of them. And so here we are.
And as you know, the governor has been pushing for Ohioans to wear masks to slow the spread of COVID-19 to the point that he mandated masks for all of Ohio. The governor wanted to make sure everyone knows the virus is still a threat and that anyone can get it.
It's you know, very contagious. It is here. It lives among us. You know, we know you're always simply dealing with trying to improve your odds. And when you wear a mask, you're improving your odds dramatically. But that does not mean you won't get it. You restrict the number of people you see. That improves your odds dramatically. But it simply does not mean that, you know, there's no guarantees. There's no guarantees in life. I don't think people should read a whole lot into this. It is other than what we already know, which is this is a very dangerous, you know, and it's very contagious.
Lieutenant Governor John Husted and the First Lady were also tested. They do not have the virus. Again, Governor DeWine tested the first time because he was supposed to greet President Trump after he landed in Ohio. The president was here in the Buckeye State to visit the Whirlpool plant in Clyde. The president addressed the number of jobs the plan has produced and the current issues with the pandemic. Before President Trump arrived in our state, Democrats here held a roundtable about the president and his policies.
We've had Pence, we've had DeVos, we've had Trump. As we said last year, I think Trump visited Ohio more than any state in the country where he didn't own a golf club last year. And there's a reason he keeps coming back. It's because on the ground, He knows, and we know, that actually his policies have failed.
He's coming for the press to cover him for a photo op. He's going to do some golf, I think, which will give him a quick cash grab. And he's going to deal with his wealthy friends that he rewarded so highly in the tax bill that has harmed the middle class in our country.
We know Ohio is important in the race for the White House. A recent Your Voice Ohio survey shows Biden ahead of President Trump in the Buckeye State by 4 points. Ohio Secretary of State went on CNN to talk about how the election will be different this year. Frank LaRose said election results could take weeks. That's because he expects the highest volume of votes ever.
Life has changed so much in the last few months, and that includes the way that the ballots are going to be counted on election night. It could take a little while longer, you're right to mention. And with us relying so much more on absentee balloting this year, we could see a lot of ballots come in after Election Day. We will receive ballots for 10 days at the boards of elections, as long as they're postmarked before Election Day. And those count. Every vote counts, and we will make sure that every vote is tabulated. We will never sacrifice speed for accuracy.
LaRose says the results on election night will be unofficial results, and the results in the official report weeks later could change. Of course, before the results start coming in, you have to vote. That's also going to look different this year.
When it comes to voting in November, you do have three options: early voting, mail-in or absentee voting, or in-person voting. But before you can do that, you need to make sure you are registered to vote. If you aren't, you need to get that done by October 5th. Just go to voteohio.gov. You'll need your driver's license or a state-issued ID.
One thing that some people take for granted, they think, oh, I've been registered to vote for years. But if you have moved since the last time you voted and you haven't updated your address, you can also get that done at voteohio.gov. One of the biggest problems that people face on Election Day is outdated information in their voter registration.
Now that that's checked off of your to-do list, let's talk about in-person early voting. That starts October 6th. You can vote early in Ohio for 4 weeks, including evenings and weekends. Ohio is one of only 5 states that has Sunday voting during the early voting period. Mail-in or absentee voting happens during those same 4 weeks, starting October 6th. About 25% of Ohioans use this option in past elections. But of course, that number, wow, it's expected to go up this year because of the pandemic. The Secretary of State's office sends an absentee ballot request to every voter in the state. You should expect that sometime after Labor Day. It does need to be postmarked by November 2nd. You can also return the ballot to your local Board of Elections. For those who still want to go to the poll on November 3rd, that will only go smoothly if 35,000 people sign up to be poll workers.
We need you to be a poll worker.
We need you to be a poll worker.
Traditionally, this role is filled by older people who, as you know, are more at risk for COVID-19. So to find a new generation of poll workers, the state is allowing people as young as 17 to take up the job. Lawyers can get CLE credits if they sign up, and companies are being encouraged to participate in Give a Day for Democracy to give their employees a paid day off to be a poll worker. To sign up, you guessed it, go online and fill out an application.
Now, we mentioned several links in that report. You can find them at 10TV.com or on our app. Now to an update in that bailout bribery investigation. Former Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder is looking for a new attorney. Householder was supposed to be arraigned on a racketeering charge, but his attorneys recused themselves, citing a conflict. The FBI alleges Householder and 4 other people took part in a $60 million bribery scheme that made them money and helped secure the passage of House Bill 6. The bill provided a $1 billion bailout to 2 nuclear power plants in northern Ohio with ties to First Energy. The FBI alleges the men used millions filtered through a dark money group to help elect Householder, other lawmakers, and ensure that the bill passed. 3 lobbyists and the former state GOP party chairman charged in connection with this case each entered not guilty pleas. We spoke with a top doc on COVID-19 testing. We'll tell you what he had to say about following protocols and our kids heading back to school.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
If you're worried your friend may be struggling, remember, you don't have to be there to be there.
You could say how while you will get a fake tattoo. You could ask with an app if it works for you. You could write him a text or knit him a sweater. If you can't be together, you could write him a letter.
Whatever gets you talking. Whatever gets you talking.
Good chat on the game, kick off your flip-flops. You can ask on your couch while you binge watch. However you do it, you gotta ask a friend. And if they don't share, you can ask again.
Whatever gets you talking. Whatever gets you talking.
Reach out to a friend about their mental health. Learn how you can help at seizetheawkward.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council, American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and the Jed Foundation.
Pass it on.
Now's the time to stay apart. Social distancing. But I'm adding something else. Pull together. What's pulling together while we're staying apart? It's calling family to check in on them. It's waving to your neighbor. It's the things we should have been doing all along. And when this tragedy passes and we're able to come together, we'll be stronger than ever. Because we've already pulled together. Stay apart. Pull together.
Pass it on.
From PassItOn.com.
This is Columbus Perspective on the Fan. Back to Tracy Townsend, courtesy of 10TV.
The nation's top doc on COVID-19 testing, Admiral Brett Giroir, told me suppressing the virus is essential and that Americans need to adhere to those familiar protocols. Wear a mask, socially distance yourself, and wash your hands thoroughly. The White House coronavirus task member says there is still reason to be careful, especially with kids heading back to class.
Getting our children back in school is such an important issue, and you've heard all of us talk about, as well as the American Academy of Pediatrics, the importance of getting children back into school for their social and for their socialization skills, for their learning, their intellectual development. But also many of our children get their emotional support, their mental illness support. They get their nutrition, eye and ear screening, all those kinds of things through the classroom that are just so very important. Now, that being said, this is an individual school or school district decision, and one size does not fit all. The CDC has given many different suggestions about how you can make your school safer, and it really depends on how bad the outbreak is in your community. If you're in a really red-hot community, you're not going to be able to go back to typical brick-and-mortar, everyone there every day.
Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown took to the Senate floor. He called on Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to, quote, stop playing politics in an effort to keep students and teachers and other staff safe during the pandemic.
I don't, you know, I'm not really sure how Mitch McConnell has spent his summer. What I do know is that in May, the House of Representatives passed the HEROES Act. It helped local governments. It helped people stay in their homes so they wouldn't be evicted. It helped our public school system. It provided $600 to unemployed workers. And, Mr. President, what's remarkable about that is even during this pandemic, we haven't seen the poverty rate go up in this country because of the $600 per week that millions of unemployed workers are receiving, which they have earned. So the House did that in May. Now, I don't know what Senator McConnell's done since, through May, through June, through July, now into August. And finally, he comes up with something. We've asked the president and the majority leader to extend that unemployment insurance. But you know what? It's pretty unbelievable to hear people in this side of the aisle making $175,000 a year as U.S. senators. Most of my colleagues are millionaires, and they complain that these unemployed workers are getting $600 a week. They complain that these workers are getting too much money as we earn $175,000 a year.
All around Ohio, more and more school districts are deciding to go virtual. Bexley made that call. 10TV's Stephanie Stanovich has their updated plan and what students think of it.
The new school year is almost here. Leah Tedes and Jaden Lumpkins are going to be seniors. They say they're feeling a lot of emotions.
I'm both excited and nervous. It's going to be a big change.
The Bexley School District has decided to do distance learning, which means starting on August 24th, students will be learning from home.
I am taking a lot of APs and honors, and it would be beneficial for me to go back. However, I understand that due to COVID-19, that's just not the safest option.
The district is following recommendations from Franklin County Public Health. Teachers and staff will begin professional development and training August 17th to the 21st.
I know it's a tough decision because a lot of parents are really pushing for us to go back, but I think the safest option is for us to stay home.
As seniors, these girls say their class is going to miss out on a lot.
I think the thing I'll miss most is probably just the school spirit. I know senior year, we have the pep rallies and prom and football games and everything, and we're going to kind of miss that.
They're a little nervous to do virtual.
I won't have as much motivation as when I'm in person because I won't have my teachers and my friends encouraging me.
But they say it's about personal responsibility and that hard work will pay off. They have big plans for after high school that they're looking forward to.
I want to be a surgeon, so I'd be on the pre-med track. I hope to major in biology and go on the pre-med track.
As for the upcoming freshmen, who they say are probably already nervous as it is without COVID-19 changes, their advice, ask a lot of questions. Reach out to others for support.
Make sure you have a strong schedule, and as long as you plan things in advance and study very hard for your tests, then you'll be able to succeed in your classes.
Reporting in Bexley, Stephanie Stanovich, 10 TV News.
District administrators will decide no sooner than September 18th if students can switch to hybrid learning. Now, to try and stop the spread of the virus, Governor DeWine pushed to stop liquor sales after 10 at night across the state. That's something the city of Columbus tried to do, but a judge stopped that effort. Of course, the governor's ban was challenged as well, but a judge backed the ban. 10 TV's Krista Frost explains the decision and has reaction from business owners.
To say restaurant and bar owners are on edge is just the start of it.
Yes, the first shutdown hurt us really bad. Put us in a hole. Put us about 6 months behind or a year. Another one will be devastating.
That's their biggest fear. And after today, that fear grew. Last week, a rule went into effect stating they couldn't sell alcohol after 10 p.m.
About 35% of my sales per day.
Gino Rifatlari owns Red Door Tavern and says this weekend was disheartening.
Saturday, I had to kick people out.
Attorney Ed Hasty is siding with owners like Gino who are concerned about what this ruling means for their business.
Make no mistake about it, Your Honor. The bar and restaurant industry is failing right now. The COVID-19 pandemic has crushed this industry. Rule 80 will be another nail in the coffin to really put this industry under.
Hasty argued that the entire industry shouldn't be punished for certain restaurants not following the rules and said health officials should step in for those who don't. The defense countered, saying there aren't enough resources to monitor every business. They also asked the question, why challenge now when businesses didn't challenge before?
The plaintiffs did not challenge the Ohio Department of Health orders closing bars.
In the end, a judge agreed with the rule, even saying the difference between an alcoholic and non-alcoholic beverage is obvious. In Columbus, Krista Frost, 10 TV News.
Ohio Senator Rob Portman spoke on the Senate floor as well. He praised President Trump for signing his bipartisan Restore Our Parks Act into law. This was part of a broader legislative package that provides permanent funding for the Land and Water Conservation Fund. A news release from Portman's office says the law will support more than 100,000 jobs over the next 5 years by rebuilding critical park infrastructure to help address the more than $12 billion backlog in long-delayed maintenance projects at the National Park Service. Okay, you sent them to Congress, and now we're checking in on them. We have our roundup of some of your congressional reps. We'll start in District 3 with Representative Joyce Beatty, who was in town talking business at the Franklin County Commissioner General session. The Congresswoman is supporting a resolution to authorize $2 million in funding through the CARES Act for emergency grants to support minority-owned small businesses facing financial hardship because of the COVID-19 pandemic. The Congresswoman is endorsing a partnership between the Columbus Urban League, One Columbus, and Franklin County government to establish three separate funding streams to help out historically underutilized and underserved minority-owned small businesses.
Let me just tell you, when we look at the number of small businesses and minority-owned businesses right here in our district, the 3rd Congressional District, we're finding out that people are asking for $15,000, $38,000. One of the larger amounts would be $150,000. And that's by people who self-identify themselves as a small business getting less than $150,000. It can make the difference of keeping your doors open and closing your doors. We have to come back with another $1,200 for hardworking people and those who fall in between the gap or the cracks. We have to also make sure that there's more money there for state and local governments. Because again, for many of our small cities right here in our communities, it's the tax base that makes a difference of keeping a city open.
Let's go to the 12th district now, where Representative Troy Balderson announced this week that telehealth services are just what the doctor ordered in his district. We've all seen how telehealth options have become commonplace in the face of the pandemic as an alternate method of getting in touch with your healthcare provider. Congressman Balderson told me a couple of days ago that hospitals and healthcare facilities in his district have seen a 400% increase in overall telehealth use since March.
The amount of kids that are at ease when they're in their own home, when they have their service dog with them, when the Legos are around, and it's not the travel an hour or 2 hours in the car to get the children to hospital, go to the parking garage, go through that, and then, you know, come to the office. I mean, and their anxiety level has gone up. So I had the, you know, I was fortunate enough yesterday, Children's Hospital actually put me with a mom of two children that have to do Nationwide Children's Hospital. And she is so grateful that they have expanded to this. And she talked about the same stories that the doctor talked about, is the importance. The service dog is with her youngest son, and they're at ease. They're in their own bedroom and they're having this conference with their doctor. And it's just, it's huge. It's been a huge impact.
The Trump administration announced some new policies that expand access to these services in rural communities. And now we move to the 15th Congressional District, where medical experts and first responders joined Representative Steve Stivers, who hosted a virtual roundtable on their frontline experiences with the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, this panel included three members of our own 10TV team of experts who talked about issues including COVID-19 testing delays and this putting forward some sort of stockpile of supplies to avoid future shortages.
I think that's exactly right. Those discussions are going on right now, and the Senate proposal would require a national stockpile to be 100% domestic within 2 years, which is a great start for building a supply chain. We also have to figure out how to make that supply chain cost competitive, because as we're seeing some PPE being made in the United States, it's, you know, 4 and 5 times more expensive. So we have to figure out how to look out for that. That's why I talk about a North American supply chain that includes Mexico that might help with some of the cost competitiveness.
And we leave you this week with a word on kindness. When Governor DeWine announced in his news conference that COVID-19 was detected in a test he took before going to welcome President Trump to Ohio, most people were surprised and eager to learn more about how he was feeling, how his wife was doing, and who else may have been exposed. Governor DeWine also shared, though, that some other people took to social media to criticize him for mask mandates and went on to call the novel coronavirus a hoax. That's sad and a poor reflection of those who exercised their keyboard courage. We can do better. And now a second chance. As we've reported, political leaders from both sides put affiliation aside to wish the governor good health. And there's a collective sigh of relief after that second test reveals COVID-19 was not detected. We are also relieved and reminded that kindness counts. Thank you so much for being here with us today. Remember, if it affects you, your family, and Ohio, we're here to make sure those accountable face the state.
That's again Tracy Townsend, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, and her Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This is Columbus Perspective on the Fan.
Hi, this is Dave James, and joining me on the phone is Terry Green. He is the founder and executive director of a nonprofit organization in town called Think, Make, Live Youth. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for talking to us. Tell us what Think, Make, Live Youth is.
Think, Make, Live Youth is a nonprofit organization based out in Columbus, Ohio, that's providing resources to support young people within the community. We primarily work with young people between the ages of 14 years old to 24 years old through our career readiness, leadership development, social justice work that we do for our young people. Primarily, the young people that we work with may have been affected by foster care or may have been affected by the justice system or those opportunity youth that are disconnected from employment opportunities to educational resources. And our mission is to provide opportunities to think greatness, make changes, and live fulfilled for those young people that are dealing with challenging circumstances. And we were an organization that was about big events, facilitating workshops, doing in-school engagements, doing after-school engagements. And due to COVID-19 and the pandemic, it really has put a challenge for our organization of how do we connect with those young people who are vulnerable? How do we connect with those young people who need access to the resources? And so we have partnered up with a few local partners. Remember Us Urban Scouts is one of our local partners. We were providing a workforce development training program through landscaping, through community gardening, through community engagement, civic engagement work. And also with that partnership, we have Impact Community Action, who is helping us out to make sure it's successful. And so due to the fact of the pandemic, we're moving to like a virtual engagement through this platform called Ascend Goals, where we're allowing the young people to accept different challenges around career readiness, conflict resolution, a lot of different challenges around, personal challenges in terms of financial literacy. And so where that organization is like meeting young people where they're at, and how can we provide them and connect them to tangible resources so they can thrive up out of their situations or to be able to just persevere in all around positive youth development.
Now, this is such an unbelievable time because obviously with the pandemic, but also with all the social justice, police reforms, but then you've got kids maybe who've lost their summer jobs, and now you've got school disrupted. I just can't imagine a more chaotic time for a kid.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge where, you know, a lot of young people just need a space where they can actually talk to people, have an aspect community relationship where they can say, hey, this is where I need support and resources, and how can you be a help to support me with those resources? And that's what, you know, our organization is looking to do, is how can we be able to say, you know, identifying young people as they, you know, either coming out of foster care or they're leaving the justice system or just like those young people that are at risk to actually connect them to those tangible resources. And really with the mission to really, we know that in Central Ohio, there's been a spark in teen violence. And the thing is, like, providing programs like ours will give young people the pathways to where they don't have to be involved in negative activities, and they can actually do positive things within their community. And so that's our mission, right? And then when you think about social justice is definitely something that we empower. We are actually in the process of planning for our virtual social justice award ceremony. Will be an award ceremony that we're honoring social justice legends and leaders right here in Central Ohio. And our award recipients are, you know, those social justice unsung heroes and sheroes right here in Central Ohio. And that's one of our fundraisers we're actually doing to support our Think, Make, Live Youth programs is the Social Justice Awards. You can find out more details at socialjusticeawards.org.
Okay, and Terry Green talking with us, founder and executive director of Think, Make, Live Youth. You know, on your website, you've got, and you've already said these words as well, words like empowerment, leadership, civic engagement, respect, youth summit events. Those are powerful words and life-changing words for youth.
Yes, and that's what we want to be, is being able to be life-changing, being able to, like I said, provide those access to the resources that
many some young people don't have, and just being that support. So, you know, in terms of leadership development, social justice, is that our young people, we know at this point in time that they want to stand up for what they believe is right, and they want to stand up for what they believe that should be, you know, the right path in terms of equal justice and racial justice within in today's society, whether that's equal access to support resources through mentorship, equal access to funding opportunities that can support them in terms of, you know, tablets or online engagements. Some young people need hotspots, and some young people may need, you know, Chromebooks to continue on their education. And so we want to be that organization that's providing those resources and supporting young people through these challenging times.
It's got to be challenging for you as well. You mentioned about going to a virtual platform. Are you learning about maybe some new ways that wouldn't have come up because of this that are helpful, or is it more of a challenge than anything?
Yes, Dave. I have been learning a whole lot in terms of this new virtual world. I mean, even for myself, with managing my staff remotely, and just being able to learn new systems, new programs. But I think it's becoming to be more innovative to ways that we could be able to connect young people to resources and to be able to engage young people. And I think that, you know, right now in this time, it's great for us to be able to move with the shift in terms of learning these new systems. And, you know, one, like I said, the challenges for us is just getting those resources so that young people can have to actually engage, being, you know, Chromebooks, being tablets, being online resources. And, there, you know, there's a way that people, you know, can donate if they want to give back. We're a 501c3, and you can donate through donorbox.org/give2youth, and that is actually a way for people that want to support and see, you know, young people like the young people that we serve at an advantage to be able to get connected to different opportunities so they could thrive.
You know, when you think about it, if a kid, a youth, does not have a Chromebook or at least some sort of tablet or, you know, something maybe a little more user-friendly, functional in a workplace or school setting than a phone, that's like a kid 30, 40 years ago that didn't even have a pencil.
Yeah, and especially at a time like this, right? And so we want to advocate for, you know, those organizations and those companies that are looking to support through social justice or through social responsibility, to look at nonprofit organizations such like ours to be able to support and build partnerships so these young people can have equal access to those resources so they can thrive up out of their situation.
Where do you see the organization going? And tell us, too, for that matter, why you started it, how it got started.
Well, the organization, you know, started from just me having a passion to want to give back, even from my personal story, from experience in youth homelessness, watching my mother get incarcerated, being disconnected from my father, and having those stories. I was one of those young people where society didn't really have too much resources and the access to those resources, and so I'm just, you know, was empowered to found this organization to be able to support other young people who experience similar stories such like myself, or stories that have, you know, are worse off. And so in the future, we look ourselves as our vision is empowered youth, strong families, empowered youth, engaged communities, and strong families. And being able to have those, you know, youth in power, having communities engaged, having families strong is our way of saying that this is what it looks like for equal justice, for social justice, for all.
That's great. Once the pandemic is behind us and we get back into more face-to-face type activities, Terry, what sorts of things are you planning for 2021?
Well, I mean, some of the things that we're planning for 2021 is really build more strategic partnerships with the juvenile justice system to be able to provide wraparound services for young people that's coming out of the system. Two, being able to lock arms with some local schools to be able to provide that in-school support, mentorship for young people. And then three, being also that support system for young people after school. So building innovative after school and leadership engagement programs and summer programs to keep young people engaged and connected to resources.
It's great. Terry Green, again, founder and executive director of Think, Make, Live Youth. Terry, give us the website and ways that folks can help your organization.
Yeah, our website is www.thinkmakeliveyouth.org, and our email address is info@thinkmakelive.org. And there's ways of support right now is supporting our 2020 Central Ohio Social Justice Awards, which will be a virtual award ceremony happening Sunday, September 20th, 2020. Check it out on our website, socialjusticeawards.org. Please be engaged and get involved. Empowering our youth, take change, make change, live change right now, today, for a better tomorrow. Think, Make, Live Youth.
It's terrific work. Terry Green, founder and executive director, Think, Make, Live Youth. Thanks so much for your time today. Sure appreciate it, and good luck.
Thank you, sir. I truly appreciate you.
This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS AM, that's 1460 ESPN Columbus, and Sunday morning at 7 on WBNS FM, Sports Radio 97.1 The Fan. Join us again next Sunday for Columbus Perspective.